Supercooled shipments of a newly approved coronavirus vaccine rolled out of a Pfizer manufacturing facility in Kalamazoo, Michigan on Sunday for rapid air freight distribution to regional hubs across the United States. Inoculations against the virus that causes the deadly COVID-19 disease will begin very expeditiously, hopefully on Monday, according to Stephen Hahn, the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, who spoke to CNN on Sunday. More than 184,000 vials were on the first trucks leaving the Pfizer vaccine production facility. Healthcare workers and elderly people at long-term care facilities will be first in line to receive the initial 2.9 million doses at a time when cases are surging in the United States. Senior government officials, including some White House staff members, will also have access to the first round of vaccines and may be inoculated as early as this week. Staff who work closely with President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence would be among the first in the nation to receive the vaccine. According to news reports, the goal is to prevent further spread of the coronavirus in the White House after multiple events there led to outbreaks earlier this year. The U.S. has recorded more cases than any other country, with nearly 300,000 deaths from the virus and more than 16 million infections, according to Johns Hopkins University. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has ordered a Christmas lockdown amid an alarming rise in coronavirus cases in Germany under new emergency measures, which will last from December 16th to January 10th. All schools and non-essential shops across Germany are to close. Bars and restaurants will also remain shut. You can follow all the stories we're covering at our website, voanews.com. You're listening to VOA News. Brexit negotiations will continue. The European Union and Britain said they would ignore the self-imposed deadline of today, Sunday, to complete post-Brexit trade negotiations. Sunday was the original deadline. The Prime Minister of the African Kingdom of Eswatini died on Sunday at a South African hospital. The Eswatini government announced Prime Minister Andrew Dlamini's death on Sunday without specifying the cause. The Prime Minister of the continent's last absolute monarchy was 52 years old. Eswatini was formerly known as Swaziland. Dlamini had been hospitalized in South Africa since December 1st, more than 2 weeks after being diagnosed with COVID-19. He announced November 15th he had tested positive for the coronavirus that causes the disease. He added that he was asymptomatic and feeling well. He was then preparing to work from home until cleared by doctors. A court in Iran has handed a 9-year jail sentence to British-Iranian anthropologist Kamil Ahmadi after convicting him of conducting subversive research work. That's according to the semi-official news agency Tasnim on Sunday. Ahmadi was also fined $727,000. That's the amount Iranian authorities said he received for his research from institutions that are accused of seeking to topple Iran's Islamic government. Other Iranian news agencies also reported the sentence, but there was no immediate comment from the government. Ahmadi's lawyer said he would appeal the sentence. After Ahmadi's arrest, his wife told the New York-based Center for Human Rights in Iran that his work was independent and published with government approval. Rights activists have accused Iran of arresting dozens of dual nationals to try to win concessions from other countries. That's a charge the Islamic Republic has regularly dismissed. A new water level tracking project partially funded by the U.S. State Department launches in China on Tuesday to monitor levels at Chinese dams on the Mekong River. The 4,300-kilometer waterway flows south from China through Myanmar, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. The Mekong Dam Monitor uses satellite data to track water levels at dams in China and elsewhere. And John le Carré, the best-selling writer of English-language spy fiction, has died at the age of 89. Le Carré's literary agency, Curtis Brown, said Sunday that he died in Cornwall, southwest England, on Saturday after a short illness. The death was not related to COVID-19. Born David Cornwell, le Carré worked for Britain's intelligence service before turning his experience into fiction, including works called Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, and The Spy Who Came in the Cold. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Prime Minister of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, has died. Today is the Inauguration Day in Ivory Coast.
A big day for Cote d'Ivoire because people have caught the President Alassane Ouattara, and it is the day when the President will do the prestation of ceremony.
Ghana's main opposition candidate provides new details why he is not ready to concede last Monday's election. Ugandan journalists protest government's new accreditation guidelines, and more than 300 students from an all-boys government school in Nigeria's Katsina state were still missing on Sunday.
The latest now is that the military joint security operatives have swung into action since yesterday, but up to now there is no feedback as to further rescue.
And fewer Ethiopian refugees are arriving in Sudan because of obstacles in Ethiopia. Those stories plus Thompson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Prime Minister of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, Ambrose Mavolo Dlamini, has died. A short statement from the kingdom's government issued late Sunday said the Prime Minister passed away Sunday afternoon while under medical care in a hospital in South Africa. The 52-year-old Prime Minister was taken to South Africa for treatment after announcing on November 16 that he had tested positive for COVID-19. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara will be sworn in today, Monday, to what his party called a new term following his re-election in the October 31 election. The opposition boycotted the election because they said the election was an unconstitutional third term for Mr. Ouattara. President Ouattara said his second term was really his first because of changes to the country's 2016 constitution. Kobina Kwasi Adumani is Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development and one of the spokespersons for the ruling RHDP party. He says today's inauguration will be attended by several heads of state.
The president and the government invited presidents of republics from Africa, the president of Burkina Faso, the president of Ghana, the president of Niger, the president of Benin, the president of Mauritania, many, many presidents. I can't list them, but I know that 13 presidents will be at this meeting. We also invited those from international institutions, the prime minister, even the member of opposition, so that tomorrow is a big day for Cote d'Ivoire because people have fought the president Alassane Ouattara, and it is the day when the president will do the prestation of ceremony.
Will any member of the opposition parties be there, say Kona Bedie, will they be at the inauguration?
Well, I don't know. Kona Bedie perhaps has been invited, but it depends on him. If he's invited that he come, it will be good. If he doesn't come also, we are going to do our meeting. So I think if they come, it can help Cote d'Ivoire to do the dialogue that we spoke about.
Mr. Kona Bedie and President Ouattara, they have been in a dialogue. Now, the opposition said they want a national conference to talk about the problems in the country.
But we don't have any difficulties here in our country. When you speak about international conference, it means that you don't have an institution which works. Here, our institution works well, so that we don't need such international conference. And I think that I am the main speaker of our party, RHDP, and I talk about what the president Bedie said, and we gave him the answer that we can't do any international conference. Of course that we can speak about dialogue. The dialogue will be done by the president and the president of Republic of Cote d'Ivoire with the president, our economy, we are not going to do anything left. So I think that we have our president. He has been voted by many people. You know the percentage of the votes. They do everything to make this votation can't be done, but it has been done. So that I think now they have to respect the position of the people of Cote d'Ivoire who choose the president, and they refuse to go to these elections, and they can't now say anything against what people have decided.
Kobina Kwasi Adumani is Ivory Coast Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development and one of the spokespersons for the ruling RHDP party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. Ghana's former president and candidate for the main opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC, says he will not create chaos and jeopardize the country's peace and stability. Mr. John Dramani Mahama says he will concede if an independent inquiry determines that he is not the winner of the presidential election. The Electoral Commission declared incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo the winner of the December 7th presidential vote with 51.59% of the votes. Mr. Mahama came in second with 47.36% of the total votes cast, but he rejected the outcome of the poll, citing voter irregularity and fraud. Mr. Mahama tells viewers Peter Clotty, who is on assignment in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, that the Elections Commission failed to completely administer the election.
In the run-up to the election, there were a lot of flaws in the process, and we kept drawing attention to them. And it's like the Electoral Commission was adamant to our call, but on election day, we saw exactly what happened. This is the most incompetent election we've had. I mean, everything about this election does not reach the standard that Ghana's Electoral Commission has attained for itself. Ghana's Electoral Commission is held in high esteem as one of the best electoral commissions. Unfortunately, this election, she can't even get the results right.
So with this rejection, what are you going to do to make your case to the people of Ghana? Since you said they voted for it, how are you going to convince them that you won the election?
Well, we know we did, and are currently doing a forensic audit of all the constituencies. First, to establish what happened, and then secondly, to reconfirm the figures that we have. Because this case might end up in court, I don't know. I cannot mention anything for now, but we're doing an audit, and based on that, we'll take whatever decision we need to take. But I think that the incompetence the EC has shown, it will be useful for us to do a forensic audit of the EC's own systems and the numbers to come to what the final number for the EC is.
But Mr. President, what is your reaction to the African Union poll observer mission that came out saying that the elections were transparent and credible and that most people were not prevented from voting? The ECOWAS poll observer mission led by Madame Johnson Sirleaf said the same thing, that it was peaceful and transparent. So what do you say to these prominent African organizations that monitored the poll, pretty much giving a stamp of approval to the elections?
Normally, when you have an observer mission like that, you need to wait and see their final report, because often they give the report up to the point of counting. And it's true, I mean, the whole day was peaceful. People went about, you know, voting without any problems, and the queues were orderly, and so they'll say all that. And there were a few instances of people caught with pre-printed ballot sheets. I mean, the video evidence is there. Normally, their final report will capture the collation process. And so this report does not capture the collation process. And a lot went wrong with the collation process.
Mr. President, 4 years ago, when you lost the election, you handed over peacefully. I was here in Accra when you held a news conference that you had called then opposition leader Nana Addo Akufo-Addo to concede. People are saying you have proven that you are a true Democrat. They said, why are you not doing the same thing now?
In the interest of the more than 6 million people who voted for me, I must uphold our democracy and hold our Electoral Commission to higher standards and hold this government to a higher standard in terms of our democracy. I mean, the way they've conducted this election, the government, President Akufo-Addo, and the Electoral Commission, is a dent to our democratic credentials as a government. And so, in my principles as a Democrat, I can't be seen to be sweeping it under the carpet and just letting it go. I think that we must bring closure to this by seeing exactly, you know, where the issues are. I mean, if an independent audit is done by the EC, we bring somebody in to crunch the numbers, do an independent audit. If I lost, why not? I mean, I'll be the first to concede and, you know, walk away. But as long as that is not done, and I know that there was a deliberate attempt to subvert the will of the people in favor of the incumbent, it will be wrong for me in terms of our democratic processes to just leave it, because we will not learn the lessons of this election. I think that we must learn the lessons of this election so that we don't repeat it in a future one.
John Dramani Mahama is the former president of Ghana, a main presidential candidate. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty, who is on assignment in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, December 14th. Over 300 students from an all-boys government science school in Nigeria's Katsina state were still missing on Sunday. Parents of the missing students have been protesting, demanding that the government bring back their children. Sani Malumfashi is the reporter for VOA's Hausa service in Katsina state.
Actually, the latest now is that the military joint security operatives, that is the police, the army, the air force, have swung into action since yesterday after the incident of the Kankara local government. What happened? But up to now, there is no feedback as to further rescue. But they were able, from that Friday night to the morning, they were able to rescue only 200 students. The school has a total population of 850 students.
So the authorities have not been able to apprehend anyone?
Not at the moment, because if they had been able to make any arrest of any of the bandits, whether dead or alive, they would have called the press and say, okay, so far we were able to get this number of bandits, whether dead or alive, they would have said that. But to this moment, nothing yet.
Has any group claimed responsibility?
No, it has not been the practice in Nigeria, apart from the Boko Haram, who would normally come to say, yes, they are responsible, to claim responsibility. But the armed bandits, many the Fulani, they don't come out to tell you that where are the people that did this. Once they kidnap, they take into the bush. After 24 hours, sometimes they do call the families of respective captives to say, okay, if you want your words, you have to pay the ransom of so amount you bargain with them. That's all the Fulani armed bandits do.
You know about the Chibok girls situation. That was, I think, 6 years ago. Is it possible similar thing may be happening now?
Not really, because for the Boko Haram, they went to the Chibok just to carry the girls, perhaps to convert them to Islam, because they say Boko Haram, which means going to education, is a forbidden something, so they wanted to do that. But these people are only out to make money. So anybody they kidnap, after 24 hours, they will talk to the family, and then when they call them, they will start asking for a figure that they will quote for you, maybe 20 million, 30 million, 10 million or so. Just for instance, what happened in with ABU students, they were asking for each student to pay 30 million to be released. But eventually, when they realized that the parents are very poor, going by what they see from their telephone in terms of bank account and what have you, so they eventually, you know, charge them according to the power of the family based on what they see in the account. So some of them paid 500,000 naira, and then the highest was 1.3 million that was paid for those 8 students that were kidnapped on their way to Lagos from Kaduna to Abuja.
Sani Malumfashi is a reporter for VOA's Hausa service, speaking with us from Nigeria's Katsina state. Ugandan media houses and journalists are not happy about new government guidelines on accreditation of journalists to cover the 2021 presidential election and other state events. Daniel Kalinaki is the chairperson of the Uganda Editors Guild.
Our concerns about the move by the media council registered journalists is basically threefold. The first is that while there is a law that gives the council the mandate to register journalists and give them practicing certificates, the names of the journalists to get the certificates are supposed to be given by an institution which pretty much no longer exists. So we are not sure that the directive by the council is actually legal as things stand. The second concern we have is that the timelines that have been given are quite difficult to meet. Asking journalists to basically sort out accreditation within 7 days in the middle of an election campaign does not sound like something that is feasible and that is useful. The third concern we have is pretty much the spirit within which this has been brought. It comes in the context of widespread violence against journalists, you know, covering the election campaign, over which the Media Council has been very, very quiet.
So, Daniel, the press release from the Media Council was on the 10th of December, and the journalists, they have until, or their current press passes will expire on the 31st of December. Are you saying that is not enough?
It's not enough. You have journalists that have already been accredited, who've been asked to go back in, basically cancel their accreditation and asked to renew their accreditation. I've looked at the form that they've been asked to fill in, and it has very personal details, you know, asking journalists whether they're married and the number of children that they have, and, you know, their physical, you know, home addresses. You know, that's quite worrisome. But, you know, primarily, the law gives the council the mandate, but it also creates a National Institute of Journalists of Uganda, which is supposed to be a peer body that has since gone into oblivion.
I know that for the 2021 election, there have been these requirements for political parties or candidates. Do these requirements impact the journalists in their coverage of the campaign?
Basically, we're having an election campaign in the middle of the pandemic, and the government has said, you know, we should have what it called a scientific campaign where people basically use the media to reach voters. But that was never going to happen because, you know, media access is not ubiquitous across the country. It's a very kind of disaggregated audience, different media houses. We're talking about 250 radio stations, many of which are owned by politicians that work close to the government and routinely do not give a chance to opposition politicians to appear on talk shows or even take advertising from them. So it's really, practically, it's come down to a rules to stop opposition candidates from campaigning while the incumbent and the ruling party have, you know, a relatively much freer hand and access to media, including the public broadcaster.
Daniel Kalinaki is the chairperson of the Uganda Editors Guild. You're speaking with us from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The UN Refugee Agency reports that fewer Ethiopian refugees are arriving in eastern Sudan because of the many obstacles they encounter while trying to flee the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations says there has been a sharp drop in the number of Ethiopians seeking asylum in Sudan. In the weeks following the Ethiopian government's November 4th military assault on Tigray, thousands of refugees were crossing the border every day. However, over the past week, the UN Refugee Agency reports fewer than 500 a day have been arriving, for a total of nearly 50,000 Ethiopian refugees who have crossed into Sudan. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says some are coming from deeper inside Tigray. He says they arrive weak and exhausted after a long 2-week trek to the border. He calls the situation extremely worrying.
Ethiopian refugees who are coming into eastern Sudan are telling us they're being robbed. They tell us about armed groups that they have to evade, increasing checkpoints, hiding in the bushes. Many more could be on the run, but we just don't have a clear picture.
The United Nations recently learned that four aid workers, three from the Danish Refugee Council and one from the International Rescue Committee, were killed in the fighting in Tigray last month. Communications have been cut off in the region since the start of the conflict, so details about the killings are unclear. Reacting Friday to this tragic event, UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock tweeted that he was saddened and outraged by the killing of the four humanitarians. He also said all parties in the Tigray conflict must respect international humanitarian law. On a related issue, Baluch says the UNHCR continues to be worried about the safety and condition of some 96,000 Eritrean refugees in Tigray. Unfortunately, he says the Ethiopian government still has not granted aid agencies access to either the civilians or Eritrean refugees caught in conflict.
Supplies are ready to go pending the finalization of these security assessments. People on the ground, after a month-long cutoff from humanitarian relief, must be in a desperate situation, and it's imperative that we reach them as early as possible.
The UNHCR and partners are calling on all sides involved in the conflict to allow freedom of movement to civilians seeking safety either inside Ethiopia or in bordering countries of refuge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the doping ban slammed on South African national rugby team winger and 2018 World Rugby Breakthrough Player of the Year, Amfiwe Diatini. The player has received a 4-year ban for taking 3 banned substances, a senior South African rugby official told AFP on Sunday. A formal announcement confirming the ban is expected to be made on Monday by South African Institute for Drug-Free Sport Chief Executive Khalid Galland. And now to Uganda, where an umbrella body that will accommodate Uganda sports federations and associations have been formed. The Association of Sports Federation of Uganda was formed to address the underfunding challenges and other issues relating to sports development. The group believes the sports federation and association union gives them a stronger voice to lobby for an increased budget for the sports subsector by the government. Moses Muhangi is the chairman of the newly formed Uganda Sports Federations and Associations.
The main objective is that we need to meet the president of Uganda as sports leaders in Uganda. This has been long overdue, and as you are all aware, all our challenges to do with sport, be it funding, you'll hear voices say it is the president who decided this.
In boxing news, Nigeria-born British heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua at the weekend beat Kubrat Pulev to retain his world heavyweight titles in front of 1,000 fans at the SSE Arena. The win by the 31-year-old means he retains his WBA, WBO, and IBF heavyweight titles. Joshua's record now stands at 24-1, and next up will be a highly anticipated title unification clash with WBC heavyweight champion Tyson Fury.
Of course I want to challenge. It's not about the opponent, it's about the legacy and the belt. Whoever's got the belt, I'd love to compete with them. If that is Tyson Fury, let it be Tyson Fury.
In athletics, 400-meter world record holder South Africa's Wayne van Niekerk has described 2020 as a difficult year for him as he recovers from a ruptured anterior cruciate ligament injury. The athlete only managed to participate in a few races this year, albeit ravaged by the COVID-19 pandemic. Van Niekerk says he's got his eyes on the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games as he targets to match or surpass his world record he set 4 years ago in Rio.
Being able to consistently train again and compete again, it's really a blessing, and it's really an opportunity I don't want to take for granted. So at the same time, I don't want to be silly.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, December 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you will have a great week.